תגוסוק אינונה ברושותן אדוק קושו ניגין יערבין אינונה ישבית קימן נורפת ביערב פוצי גרין נקונק נניה Inuim Nayari Mi
Hello and welcome to Ocean Research Project. I am Matt Rutherford, Executive Director of Ocean Research Project, Captain of the Alt, and we're in Greenland. I'm currently sitting in a dinghy, just sort of drifting around right now. It's about 6 in the morning. I think I went to bed at about 2 in the morning. Everybody else on the boat is still sleeping. We got a really busy schedule ahead of us. This is sort of my only opportunity for the next week to do this show and to get it out. You'll probably hear the dogs barking in the background. Pretty typical feature of Greenland, especially north of Upernavik, is dogs. They still use dogs for dog sleds, and so you sort of have dogs tied up all over the hillsides in little groups. They don't let the dogs get too close to each other. Well, in some situations they do, and some they don't. The dogs will kind of fight to the death. Greenlandic dogs are one of the oldest breeds, I guess, in existence. They go back thousands of years. You cannot bring another dog to Greenland, so they want to keep it a purebred dog, and so basically every other dog has been outlawed. I believe I could probably bring like a wiener dog or something, you know, or a Schipperke, or, you know, I could probably bring a small dog with me as a sailor who's just here temporarily. But if you're living in Greenland, you're not allowed to have another dog, you know, like a black lab or golden retriever or anything like that. Not that anybody would. These dogs are not, you know, these aren't pets. These dogs don't go in houses. The Humane Society would have a heart attack if they saw how the dogs were treated. And I'm not saying necessarily the dogs are treated bad. I mean, it's just their culture, and it's the way these dogs have been treated for thousands of years. But, you know, they're always outside. They sleep outside even in the wintertime. You know, it's negative 40 and they're outside. They never go in the house. It's just natural. I mean, these dogs aren't used to it. I think these dogs would probably freak out if you brought them in a house. From what I understand, they actually hate being in buildings. And, you know, it's not uncommon if you go to the trash dump. And we do go to the trash dumps in a lot of these towns looking for various items. They actually throw away some pretty decent stuff in Greenland. You know, different materials. Fire hose is a good one I'm always looking for. Fire hose makes really good chafe protection. So I'm always trying to, it's always got my eye out to see if I can find some fire hose for chafe protection. But anyways, it's not uncommon to see a half dozen dead dogs sort of piled on top of each other at the dump. Anyways, it's, as I said, it's like 6 in the morning. I'm sitting in this dinghy. I'm just drifting around right now. I'm having my morning cup of coffee here. I'm always up before everybody else. Everybody is still sleeping. I mean, you know, I'm the captain of the ship. I would love to still be asleep, but, you know, it's sort of a good rule of thumb to, well, you gotta lead by example. And leading by example is really the only way to lead. And if people see that you're up and dragging yourself out of bed before everybody else on a regular basis, you know, you set a good example. You set a precedent. If you work hard, you're more than likely the people around you will work hard, and if you slack off, the people around you will slack off. And as somebody in a leadership position, it's important that you understand that. And like I said, nobody wants to be bossed around. You lead by example. You don't lead by talking. You lead by doing. And, well, what I'm doing right now is sitting in a dinghy, drifting around, drinking coffee, but I don't really see the purpose right now of rowing to land. It's a flat, calm day. I'm not getting blown around very much. I could row over to shore, but why? You know? I mean, it's just a bunch of sand there, and I mean, I can see the trash dump in Connacht. I've already been there. the town is still asleep right now. So, you know, it's, nobody really gets stirring in these Greenlandic towns until 8 o'clock or so anyways. Actually, in some towns, like in Upernavik, it's not uncommon for little kids to be out running about at 2, 3 in the morning. Sort of something you're not used to seeing in European towns or in American towns because, you know, you want your kids home at night, partially because I guess they might keep some side of schedule or whatever, but, you know, part of it's because there's bad people running around. You know, you don't want your kids to be messed with or, I don't know, abducted or any of these sort of crazy things. But, you know, in Upernavik, groups of kids will be out playing soccer and things like this until, you know, 4 or 5 in the morning. Why not? You know, I mean, it's a small town. Everybody knows everybody. It's not like your kid's going to get abducted in this little town of, you know, 1,000 people. So the kids can sort of run free, and they can run free all night long if they want to. But again, night is a relative term because it doesn't get dark. Anyways, pretty icy around here. It's always icy in front of Connacht. There's always a ton of ice piled up here. There is a long fjord. It does go back from here. It goes back another 40 miles. Quite a few glaciers terminate in this fjord. This is Inglefield Fjord, Inglefield Bredning. I don't know what they were thinking exactly when they picked this location for the settlement. As I mentioned in an earlier episode, Connacht used to be about 100 miles south of here, and when the U.S. built a military base around the time of World War II, we resettled the population to this location. And I'm sure when the Army Board of Engineers was, looking at a map and trying to, you know, check things off the list, this thing seemed like a really great spot. But being that, you know, I've been up and down this fjord several times, this is one of the iciest parts of the fjord. This is where, like, ice always sits. It's like, could they have built this town in a more icy area? But it makes it, sorry, I'm trying to drink my coffee before it gets cold. As you can imagine, it's fairly cold. Whoa, I don't know if you guys just heard that. That was a iceberg falling apart behind me, rolling around. There is probably, God, I can't even tell you how many pieces of ice I'm looking at right now. Hundreds, I guess. Some of them are big, giant icebergs. I got a piece about a boat length away right now that's, I don't know, probably the size of a garage or something. I don't know, whatever. I mean, it's, you just get so desensitized to the whole thing. You know, it's just, you're just so used to seeing ice. Although it is, of course, you know, 6 in the morning, so it is a little cold. The sun isn't setting it still at this time of year. The sun doesn't start to set until the 22nd at this latitude. But it has been warm. It's, you know, we were here last year in the same area, and it was a good 10 degrees Fahrenheit colder. And so it's been a much warmer year, and that seems to have brought a lot worse weather. It's actually brought a really bad sort of weather pattern that's making it very difficult for us to get our research done. The winds sort of seem to start picking up on Monday. We can't map the seafloor or lower the CTD probes in anything more than about 15 knots of wind. So the wind picks up on Monday, it starts blowing maybe 15. By Tuesday, it's blowing 25 to 30. And by Wednesday, it's a full-blown gale. And then Thursday comes and it sort of peters out again. And then you get a few days of, you get 3-4 days of calm weather. And then that all sort of, the cycle starts over. I don't, you know, it's the strangest thing, really. 3 weeks in a row, we've had the same exact weather pattern, and I'm looking at the forecast, and it's only going to get worse. The dogs are barking like crazy. I'm sorry. You know, normally, you know, like the barking dogs, like your neighbors, or, you know, you're like, man, shut that dog up, man, you know, stupid barking dogs. But in Greenland, it's just such a normal part of reality. It's just a normal part of life. Dogs are always barking and howling like crazy all the time. It just becomes white noise, like you don't even hear it unless you're trying to do something like a radio show, and then all of a sudden it becomes painfully obvious that dogs are barking all around you. But anyways, this weather pattern has sort of been screwing us up. We have had some good news yesterday, some really good news. A couple of really great things happened. Finally got the $5,000 of funding that one of our partners, well, we haven't gotten it in the bank yet. I probably shouldn't even be saying this, but I'm going to end up jinxing myself. But I got an email saying that we're about to get it. So that's really good, as we've been really struggling with money. Sorry, got to drink my coffee before it gets cold. We've been struggling with money because this, you know, we planned on having this back in July, and so we were supposed to have this 28 days ago, and unfortunately what this means is, you know, I've been having to be basically a food Nazi, and I don't want to be a food Nazi, but food is expensive in Greenland. And, you know, we just haven't had the money to buy some of the nicer types of food. So we've been living off of rice and cheap pasta and, you know, even like a can of Spam. You know, we haven't been able to really afford very often. And my crew hasn't been very happy about it, or at least my third mate hasn't been very happy about it. Eating rice and cheap pasta all the time. And it's been a cause of more than one argument on board the boat. But, you know, and we just, it was unexpected. We don't have the funding. So anyway, to find out we had the funding was a really great thing, because then we were able to go to the grocery store yesterday and actually buy a bunch of cans of Spam. I'm not a big fan of Spam typically, but when you're on an expedition of this nature, if you chop up some Spam and you fry it up nice and crisp, it's pretty damn good, really. But we were able to get some items, you know, we were able to get some luxury items that weren't just rice and Spam. So that's good. At the very least, that should keep the crew happier. Sort of both of my crew members, well, everybody on the boat has some sort of medical issue besides me. You know, maybe I got like a mental issue, I don't know. But everybody else has a medical issue. Nicole has a vitamin B12 deficiency. Nicole cannot get vitamin B12 by eating food or taking pills. So she can take B12 vitamins all day long, and she's not going to absorb the B12 into her body. She has to inject B12 into her body, and that's the only way she's going to get it. Now, the relevance of B12 is B12 has been linked to memory loss and Alzheimer's. And a study at Harvard was actually the study that linked it to Alzheimer's. And my grandparents are getting old and getting up into their 80s, and my mom actually read that study, and my grandma was forgetting a lot of things. You know, she'd pick up a phone and forget what a phone was. You know, she wasn't even forgetting who she was calling. She was straight up forgetting, like, what this device was in her hands. And my mom started having them take regular B12 injections, and, you know, all of a sudden they're acting like they're 10 years younger, and memory has come back. So it had quite an effect on them. And so I learned a lot about this sort of through that. But Nicole, problem is, Nicole forgets to take her B12 injections because she gets forgetful because of this. So Nicole needs B12 injections. That's not a horrible, you know, horribly difficult thing. Dana has diabetes, type 1 diabetes, I believe it is. Dana has to inject insulin 4 times a day. If Dana does not inject insulin 4 times a day, he will go into a diabetic shock, coma, and then death. So it's important that we keep his insulin somewhere safe. And, you know, obviously here in the Arctic, we're in a lot of remote places, and remote places for a long period of time. We got a lot of extra insulin. He can't have any sugary items because of this. That's not that difficult of a thing to get around. Then it means more sugary items for Nicole. Nicole likes her chocolate and her Nutella and things of this nature. Her little perks, which now that we have funding, I was able to buy her Nutella for the first time yesterday, and got her, you know, that's like a major event to for her to be able to have like a tub of Nutella for herself. Alexander, the cameraman, has something called PKU, which I'd never heard of PKU before this expedition, but PKU basically means he can't eat anything with protein in it. So imagine that one. I mean, that's a real difficult one. I mean, everything has protein in it. He can have a very small amount of protein, but basically he's got a disorder where protein turns to poison in his body, and it eats his brain. So if he were to eat a normal diet like you and I eat, he would have permanent brain damage within 2 weeks. So he has about 100 pounds of special protein-free food that he has to eat. If you think a vegan has a strict diet, I mean, his diet, you know, would be strict to a vegan. I mean, he can't eat anything, practically. He can eat, like, potatoes and popcorn and just a few other items. But, you know, these guys, these ailments are not, you know, they didn't ask for it. You know, they were born with it. And, you know, I'm not going to deny somebody a spot on my ship because of something that they have no control over. You know, you could be missing an arm and a leg, but if you got the right attitude and it's the right circumstances, I'll bring you on board. You know, I'm not going to hold that against you. But anyways, we got to go to a commercial break. I'll be back.
Hi, I'm Sarah O'Kelly, founder of Skipper's Review. I started Skipper's Review because I wanted somewhere online for my local boating community to make connections and recommendations. So now it's up and running. I've been getting out of the office to enjoy the Florida sunshine and to meet some of my members. Each week, you can hear me swapping salty tales with sailors, surfers, swimmers, divers, boat owners, and builders, anyone with a story to tell about their life and their relationship with the sea. So join me, Sarah O'Kelly, with Skipper's Review on Boat Radio.
Hi, I'm Dave Dempsey from Marine Intelligence. If you're the owner or captain of a superyacht, then you know how expensive internet can be. And yes, it's a ripoff. We've made it our mission to revolutionize the world of marine communications. We will find you the best price for your internet by comparing all major vendors. And we do that for free. That's right, no charge to the boat. It's a free service. We get you the best price for your yacht, whether it's just one boat or a fleet of boats, and all the savings will be passed on to you. We can save you over $1,000 per meg. So stop doing what you're doing and visit marineintelligence.net now, before you forget.
Hello, I'm Captain Bob May from Bob's No Wake Zone Boating Radio Show, and you're listening to Boat Radio.
Hello and welcome back to Ocean Research Project. I am Matt Rutherford, drifting around in a dinghy outside of the town of Conock, about 77 and a half north. Drifting around in a dinghy because everybody else on my boat is still sleeping, and I had to get up to do this radio show and sort of set an example, I guess. I didn't really want to do it on the boat because I didn't want to disturb anybody. It's going to be a lot of hard work coming up here pretty soon. And I don't really feel like rowing to land, so I'm just sort of sitting here drifting around. It's flat, calm conditions right now. I am actually getting blown away from my boat some distance at this point, so it might be a good idea to to row. And I got a small boat approaching me at a million knots, as they do here in Greenland. Well, I don't know, maybe 20 knots or 22 knots. Flying right through the ice. I'm sure you can hear the guy creeping up. He's going to pass me by pretty quickly. I imagine this Greenlandic guy in this small fiberglass boat is wondering what in the hell this white guy is doing drifting around in a dinghy talking into this microphone. I'm amazed how fast these guys go around the ice. I mean, this guy's going by waving at me right now and looking at me like I'm crazy. But I am amazed. They go flying along at top speed, surrounded by ice. I don't know how they do it. I don't know how they don't hit the ice more often. I mean, all I can imagine is that they've been doing it for a long time, and they, I guess, grow up around the ice. And when you first start, you know, driving your boat around heavy ice, you know, you're going half a knot and a knot, and you know, you're looking all over the place. But after a while, you get so used to it that you're just, you know, moving along. I'm, you know, my boat's not very fast. If I'm going 4.5 knots, 5 knots, that's about max speed for me without burning too much fuel. I go my regular cruising speed, just as I'd go in the Chesapeake Bay, in most ice conditions at this point. You just get used to navigating ice. But anyways, the guy is gone. It looks like he's made it into town. Things are going to get busy. As I said, there was some good news earlier. One of the good things were that we got some funding, and now we can buy luxury items like Spam, and I can get Nikki Nutella, and I can quell the rebellion that was building upon my vessel as people were getting tired of not having luxury foods. It's hard for me to be too sympathetic, to be honest. I mean, I'm used to losing weight on expeditions. I'm used to living off of anything, I guess. I mean, we've had a lot of tough expeditions over the years, and it's just part of, to me, it's just part of going on an expedition. They last for months. You lose 15, 20 pounds. You know, sleep deprivation and hunger are just a normal part of the expedition. But not everybody is used to these sort of situations. Even people who are rather tough aren't used to dealing with that type of toughness. So anyways, we got some food. We got Spam. I can't ever imagine being excited about having Spam in the past, but anyways. So we got to start this big survey. We had a problem, and I didn't want to talk about it earlier because it's for a number of reasons, but we have this sonar system that we invested in this year. It's about a $25,000 sonar system. This is a crucial piece of equipment for mapping the seafloor. We also have like a Simrad, on steroids, basically. They can see down 3,000 feet. They see down roughly 1,000 meter. But the problem is, we used this last year to do some seafloor mapping, but it's because it's made for like civilian private pleasure craft, I guess you'd say. It produces a file that can't really be processed. It's a nightmare to try to process it. You got to be able to process your files for proper like science. And so this unit is sort of, you know, it's on the low end. I mean, $25,000 seems like an expensive sonar, but it's the sort of an economic model. It sees down about 6,000 feet, a couple thousand meters. And it produces this file that can be processed in HiPAC or Sierras, which are proper software for processing this sort of data. It's a professional grade sonar. So anyways, we needed this thing, and $25,000 is I'm over here talking about not being able to afford buying Spam for the last 3 weeks. You can imagine how difficult it is for me to get 25 grand to try to put a sonar in the boat when I can't even hardly get a can of Spam. And part of the reason why we have so little money is because I invested almost everything we had into scientific equipment before we left. It's just sort of the nature of the beast, I guess. We have to have the equipment. So we invested about $12,000 into the system. We got a brain, which is the main unit, was about $15,000. We got it as a loaner. It was really nice for Teledyne Odom to give us this loaner unit, but it's a loaner unit. God knows how old it is. God knows who's used it before us, how long it's been sitting on a shelf in a warehouse. It's sort of like cross your fingers and hope it works. And it was broke. You know, I don't put it on them. There was no signs that it was going to break when they gave it to us, and they ran tests on it. So basically, Sonar 101, and this goes with depth sounders, a decent depth sounder, a fish finder, it's all the same principle. You have high frequency and you have low frequency. So high frequency, like 200 hertz, high frequency is going to be for shallow water, and the low frequency is for deep water. So if you want your, if you got a good fish finder or a good sonar on your boat, a good depth sounder, you will be able to change the frequency. That will be a setting. And if you find yourself in deeper waters and you want that thing to see further down, you got to change it to the lowest frequency that it's capable of. On the Simrad, that's like 50 hertz. On this CV200, it's 20. We absolutely need that lower frequency in order to be able to read below 600 feet. The high frequency is only good to 600 feet. This is a very deep fjord. It becomes 1,500 feet in this fjord in a very short period of time from leaving land. It's the nature of a lot of these fjords. These fjords get deep very quickly. Most of this fjord is between 2,000 and 3,000 feet deep. So, you know, it's around 1,000 meters deep out in the middle, and it stays deep. So I'm always speaking, by the way, in both metric and imperial. I'm trying to give measurements everybody will understand here. So we get this unit, and we're getting out there, and we're starting to collect this data, and you know, we start off in high frequency. There's one section of the survey that's shallower, that's less than 600. So we start there. And we didn't start there necessarily because it's shallower. We started there because it's this northwest area, and we just sort of wanted to get it done. And I talked a little bit about it last episode. It's this area where nobody had really collected any data, and except for us last year, we did a preliminary thing. And so I don't know. It's kind of cool. We mapped out this, you know, the first people to map out this section. This whole area hasn't really been mapped out at all. But that area, it was like super unmapped. Really, this whole fjord is too. I mean, there's a few soundings on the chart, but they're inaccurate. I mean, they could be off by 400 or 500 feet. I'm sorry, I'm drifting further and further from my boat. I probably should row here in a few minutes. I'm starting to get some distance away. But anyways, so we switch over to try to get low frequency to work. And, you know, Nicole's having problems getting it to work, and it's getting frustrating. It's like, oh, man, you know, there's like gain and different things you can tweak. And so we're tweaking the different settings and, you know, why isn't this low frequency reading the seafloor? Why aren't we getting it to work? And, you know, what are we doing wrong here? I mean, this is a pretty simple unit. I mean, they don't make them more simple than this unit. Like, why is this thing not working? It was driving us crazy. And we're sending all these emails to, like, their tech support, which is really one guy, and down in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. So we're sending all this stuff back and forth to this guy in Louisiana, and I don't know. It didn't make any sense. So we just kept doing the high frequency, the shallow water, and Nicole was on watch, and I was sleeping, and she wakes me up and says, you know, we're smelling something out here. Something isn't right. And that's never a good sign. You know, if anybody ever tells you they're smelling something ain't right, you better jump up and start sniffing. Your eyes are obviously important on a sailboat to recognize problems, but your nose and your ears are also crucial. If you hear something that doesn't sound right, chances are either something is broken or something is about to break. And if you smell something that smells like smoke, you better get your ass in gear and find out where it's coming from. And that was the case. It smelled like wires burning. And so we're sniffing around, and, you know, it's like, oh, where is this wire smell coming from? And I can smell, you know, it's a sort of familiar smell. Anybody who smelled the smell of electronics dying, and I knew within about 60 seconds it was the unit. I took the cover off the unit, got a nice big whiff, and it was definitely coming from it. It's like, oh, Christ, this unit that's, you know, we've invested $12,000 into our boat. We've welded this giant transducer onto the bottom of our boat so we can, you know, do this mapping. It's, you know, and now the unit's broken, and this is our primary scientific objective. It's with NASA. Now we got to tell NASA scientists that our equipment is broken. That doesn't make us look very good. I mean, they're understanding enough of the situation, but still, they don't want to hear that sort of thing. And they're, I'm sure, a little curious of, well, was it bad equipment or did we break it? And, you know, Teledyne Odom was probably a little curious, too. We did talk to the tech support. We went through a series of tests over the satellite phone and determined that it was just their motherboard just sort of burned out. This is not normal. Nicole has used one of these units for years on other survey boats and used them hard, you know, around the clock for days and days at a time. This is a notoriously robust unit. So it's not a normal thing for it to happen. But as I said, it's a loaner unit. God knows how old it is, and who knows what it's been through before we got our hands on it. And, you know, it's just the nature of this situation we're in. When you don't have the money to buy things new, and what else are you going to do? You try to get companies to give you what's laying around on their shelf until you can get the funding to buy new. We do hope to buy a new unit. You know, at the end of this expedition, we get some money from NASA. But NASA is not giving us any funding. I mean, we are subcontracted by NASA. We have a contract with them, but we don't get any funding until the expedition is over. We're basically farmers. You know, we're getting paid like a farmer gets paid. If there is a drought or if there is a flood, the farmer loses the crops and the farmer is screwed, basically. So if we have a drought or a flood, if we lose our equipment, if there's too many bad weather days, whatever it is, and we're not able to get the data that we put in the contract that we would get, then we're screwed. It's not a situation I like being in, and maybe I'll be able to renegotiate the contract next year so, you know, we get some money up front or we have some guaranteed funding locked in. But, you know, NASA had all the leverage this year, and so I really just couldn't argue too much with them. Yeah, it's just difficult. So anyways, I had this broken unit, and, you know, so now you're sitting in this random remote part of the world, 77 and a half north. What are you going to do? How are you going to get another sonar? I mean, it's just a nightmare situation to be in. You know, to Odom's credit, they sent us another unit that day. Within an hour of diagnosing it, they had another unit in FedEx. FedEx International Priority mailed it off to Konak, Greenland. But that's, you know, that process is slowed. You know, it showed up in Denmark within 24 hours. It showed up in Greenland within 48 hours, and then it sat in Kangerlussuaq, which is like the international airport in Greenland, for the next 10 days, just sitting there for 10 days. And we had like a FedEx tracking number, and I gave it to my sister, and I couldn't get internet access to actually look up the FedEx tracking number because we're out doing research, but through the satellite email, like, you know, every day, I was like, hey, where's it at? She's like, it's still in Kangerlussuaq. And it's like, oh my God, are we ever going to see this unit? And we're running out of time. I mean, this is a very time-sensitive project. It's a huge project, and I'll get into that more in a minute. But, you know, we only have about 6 weeks maximum that we can operate at this part of the world. Because if you show up too early, it's full of ice. And after that, it starts getting dark, and it starts getting cold, and the ice comes back. And so it's like we got a very small window of opportunity that we can do seafloor mapping up here. And yeah, so it was a very tense situation, and it has been for the last 2 weeks. And like I said, I didn't want to talk about it until I had something good to say, or until I had no choice because we weren't going to get it in time. But anyways, we found out yesterday that it showed up. So we were able to go to Hotel Konak. Hotel Konak is a, kind of a house. And this guy, Hans Jensen, this Greenlandic guy with a Danish name, he let us ship it to Hotel Greenland, and by God, if it wasn't sitting there in a box, and what a great day. We got our funding. We found out we got our funding, and we found out we got our replacement sonar within like a half hour of each other. Like two great pieces of news. Anyways, got to cut the commercial break. I'll be back.
Earliest prehistory reveals mankind's innate connection to the sea, from boats of woven reed in Egypt, to Homer's black ships of the Trojan War, down to the naval battles of Greece, Rome, and every civilization since. I'm Brandon Huebner, and I'll present the history, archaeology, and literature that connect us with our past on the sea, all that on the Maritime History Program. Join me as we voyage down through the ages and witness the development of sailing, trade, and much more. The Maritime History Program, with me, Brandon Huebner, every Wednesday here on Boat Radio.
This is Edward Smith from OPA Racing.
This is Ken Little, president of Glock Performance Boat Challenge.
Hi, this is Frank Pillsbury with Marine Max and the DFW International Boat Show in Dallas, Texas.
We explore all kinds of boating topics on Bob's No Wake Zone Boating Radio Show. Hi, I'm Captain Bob May. We get underway, making way, Saturday evenings here on Boat Radio.
This is Heather Lohe, director of membership for Boat US. Thanks for listening to Bob's No Wake Zone Boating Radio Show.
I'm Michael John, and each month on Boat Radio, I'll be looking at life on London's magnificent River Thames, from the dredgers emptying their cargoes of sand and gravel, to the mudlarks combing the shore for lost treasures. I'll be meeting the people, visiting the places, and boarding the ships that work this mighty, muddy artery. So join me, Michael John, for Tales of the Thames on Boat Radio.
Yeah. Hello and welcome back to Ocean Research Project. I'm Matt Rutherford, Executive Director of Ocean Research Project, Captain of the Alt. Ocean Research Project is science, education, and exploration. I am sitting in a dinghy, drifting around in Greenland. Starting to get cold. I never bring gloves with me when I do this. I should probably start bringing gloves when I do this radio show, because I seem to always be outside, and by this point in the show, my hands are always, like, numb. But I gotta hold this microphone, and I don't know. It's also early, man. It's like 6:30 in the morning by this point, and, you know, after about 4 hours of sleep, I drug myself out of bed. This is my last opportunity that I can really do this show or send it out for the next week, as we're about to really kick into high gear now that we got this sonar again. As I was explaining, one of our most important pieces of scientific equipment broke in, like, the top of the world, you know, 800 miles from the North Pole. Go through all this chaos. The company sends us a new one. It gets caught up in the Greenland International Airport for 10 days. We're wondering if the thing's ever going to show up. I'm in, like, $13,000 of debt right now because I had to take out all sorts of loans to cover gaps in the funding, because we couldn't get any grants this year. We had professionally written grants. It's just we're doing geophysics. And geophysics is not something that nonprofits do. The type of research we're doing is the type of research that PhD scientists do, who are connected to universities and large institutes. They get their funding through the National Science Foundation or through NOAA, although typically it's National Science Foundation. National Science Foundation is not about to give a small nonprofit funding to do an expedition like this. Maybe in another few years, after we've done it enough times, we might have a chance, but they're very competitive grants. So where do you turn for funding? You know, small foundations but these foundations don't really like funding. They like funding research that's directly connected to animals. You know, if I was collecting polar bear poop so it could be analyzed to see what they're eating, or if I was counting seal colonies or looking at narwhals, counting narwhals or something, there's a lot of narwhals around here, then that's sort of thing that they're used to funding. They like to have an animal connected to it because it makes it easier for the foundation to get the funding. You know, they can show it to people, look at this seal, look at this ray, look at this shark, look at this narwhal. It's sort of like hard to do, like, you know, look at this seafloor mapping, you know. But, you know, geophysics is very important. We need to understand this. This survey, we are working with NASA's, we are subcontracted by NASA's Ocean Melting Greenland program. This group believes there is a warmer, saltier water column deep in the water, about 200 to 300 meters down, which is coming up from the Atlantic and eating the glaciers from underneath. The eating of the glaciers from underneath speeds up the flow of the glacier, speeds up their rate, and therefore helps them melt faster. The relevance to that is that if you were to melt all of the glaciers on Earth outside of Greenland and Antarctica, you'd have about a half a meter of sea level rise. If you melt Greenland, you have 7 meters of sea level rise. If you melt Antarctica, you have 54 meters of sea level rise. There's a whole lot of ice down there. But Antarctica is more protected than the Arctic. Antarctica has colder currents around it that sort of help to block some of these warmer currents, where Greenland doesn't have that. Greenland, the currents coming up from the Atlantic, and as things get warmer, the ocean gets warmer too. As the Earth gets warmer, I'll get into all this stuff later, but in a different episode, we'll get into it in more detail, talking to experts and all that sort of thing. We'll talk to the NASA scientists we're working with. But we are pitifully unprepared for sea level rise, is really what it comes down to. And the first thing that's going to contribute to sea level rise will be the Greenland ice cap. So this Ocean Melting Greenland NASA program is really dedicated to trying to figure out how fast the Greenland ice cap is melting and get some really good numbers on that. And so we're out here trying to help them figure out the health of the Greenland ice cap and its surrounding fjords by mapping the seafloor, looking for this warmer, saltier water column, and lowering a CTD probe, which can do temperature conductivity and depth, and that will confirm as it falls through the warmer water column. It records the water being warmer, and that's like confirmation that its water column exists and is here. And we have found it. We have done, over the last 2 years now, we have done about 115 of these casts all over Greenland. Well, all over northwest Greenland, I should say. And we found it all over the place. So anyways, the sonar finally shows up. The Mark III, I mean, this thing is old school, man. I mean, I don't know how long it's been sitting on their shelf, and I certainly hope it works well. We had problems with our low frequency on the other one. But it has, like, a paper readout. Like, it's... they haven't had paper readouts on sonars, I don't know, since like the 1960s or 1970s or something like that. Maybe this is a 1980s model. I don't know, but I think it's really cool looking, personally. I mean, it has the same guts as the newer models. It does the same thing. It has the same capabilities. It's just a whole lot bigger and a whole lot heavier, and it has this, I think it's really cool, little paper readout. So it, like, you know, it's like a printer thing. It, like, prints out the seafloor. It's irrelevant. We just hook it up to a computer and re-record everything. Obviously, we're not going to be using paper. We're not going to hand NASA scientists a whole bunch of paper of the mapped out seafloor. You know, we have about 1,300 miles of seafloor mapping we have to do in this. It's a small area, really. It's really jam-packed. We're detailing this region in a really unprecedented level. And 1,300 nautical miles is a lot of miles. That's like trying to map the seafloor from the mouth of the Chesapeake Bay to the Virgin Islands. Except you're surrounded by ice, you're in uncharted waters, there's rocks everywhere, uncharted rocks, just waiting to, you know, to sink your boat, basically. It's, you know, I do enjoy sailing in uncharted waters. I enjoy the extra element of the challenge. You know, it feels like exploration when you have no idea how deep anything is anywhere, and it is proper exploration, and I like that. You know, I mean, my heroes are Shackleton and Amundsen, and you know, Scott definitely had his personality quirks, but Scott had great men, you know, Wilson, Oates, Bowers, Birdie, Tom Crean, you know. So anyways, I'm a big fan of the explorers, and this is about as close as you're going to get to old school exploration these days. But we need weather. We need good weather, man. You can't do this sort of thing when it's blowing 20 knots. The wave action screws up your ability to properly read the seafloor, because you're getting knocked all around. Speaking of getting knocked all around, I'm drifting in this dinghy and I'm about to bounce off a piece of ice. I don't know if I'm going to hit it or not. It's a pretty big piece of ice, about the size of a school bus. Looks like I'm going to miss it. I got to stay away from this ice. I got to be careful. If that piece of ice were to flip right next to me and knock me in the water, I'm dead. There's no way I could get to land, or there's no way I could get back to my boat before the water temperature would kill me, before I'd go into shock. You got to treat the water here like it's hot lava. If you fall in, you're dead. So, anyways, I miss the iceberg, so I'm alive. I'm drifting around in a dinghy because everybody's still sleeping on the boat. I don't want to disturb them, and this is my only real opportunity to do this show. I wish I was sleeping. You know, we got a long schedule ahead of us. So anyways, you got to map these lines. And mapping seafloor lines are just, it's the most hectic. You know, imagine you got this line, and you got to stay within 20 feet of this line. 20 feet, and that's it. It's all the distance you can get. So you're staring at this monitor that's in front of you. You got the wheel. You're at your wheel. You got this a monitor in front of you. The monitor is connected to the laptop. The laptop is recording, is connected to the sonar. Everything's all connected together. It's recording the seafloor. Nicole runs all this. Nicole's the captain of science, basically. She's the one who knows how to run all this equipment. And so you got this line in front of you, and you gotta stay on the line. And that would be difficult enough in charted waters without ice everywhere. So you do it, you know, we have two people. We're working five on, five off. And we work around the clock. It's not like you pull anchor and you survey for 8 hours and then you go and drop anchor and eat dinner and go back to bed. We operate 24 hours a day around the clock for up to a week straight, depending on weather. But weather has just been pretty much Well, it's been warm and windy this year. It's been a lot warmer than last year, and it's been a lot windier than last year, which is making things difficult for us, at the very least. But it's hard, man. It's really arduous. You gotta, if you daydream for just a few seconds, you'll go off course. And I'm always daydreaming, so it's, you know, you really gotta focus. So you have one person driving the boat, staring at the screen. You have another person looking ahead for ice, because the person driving the boat isn't really looking ahead. You know, they gotta stare at this screen to make sure they're still on course. And we only do it for 30 minutes at a time. So you have a 5-hour watch. You drive the boat for 30 minutes. The other person drives it for 30 minutes. 30 minutes is all you can take doing this. It's just so tedious. After 30 minutes, you just want to scream and jump off the side of the boat, you know? And when the fog comes, when it gets foggy, geez, you have no frame of reference, you know? It's like it's nearly impossible to stay on the line. You're in this pea soup fog. You're throwing the wheel over hard one way. You're throwing the wheel over hard the other way. You throw the wheel around so much you get sore wrists. Like, it's just, so anyways, it's a lot of work. It's hard work, and it goes around the clock, and you're tired and all the rest. We had some weather the other day, a few days ago. It was supposed to blow 25 knots, and so we duck in, and it's been this normal weather pattern where, you know, it picks up on Monday and blows 20-25 on Wednesday, and a gale on Thursday, and, you know, just like last radio show, I mean, I was hiding from a gale. And so, whatever, though, it's only supposed to blow, you know, 25, 30 knots. I mean, that's not a big deal. So we go and drop. I got a really big anchor. I got a 70-pound Rockna anchor and a whole bunch of 3/8 chain, which is a really big setup for a boat my size. You know, I could anchor a 60-foot boat with this ground tackle, and that's the way I like it. I like having a big anchor. You know, so we go in there, we drop anchor in the fjord, we get some protection. And it doesn't blow 25 to 30. It blows 25 to 30 on Tuesday, but on Wednesday it blows 50. It blows 50 with like 70 knot gusts. These gusts were coming down from the mountains. They were, you know, catabolic winds. They were willy walls. And they were coming down, and when they hit the water, they were so strong that they instantly turned the water into mist, into this like swirling, flying cloud of mist. And, you know, one surefire way to know it's blowing like hell is when it's blowing so hard that it turns the surface of the water into mist. And when, you know, you see these clouds of mist whipping around, and when one of these clouds hits your boat, you better be holding on to something. Our boat was heeling over 25 and 30 degrees on anchor. And when the first gust hit us, we had just got done doing dishes, and all of our dishes crashed. We broke almost all of our dishes. Ugh, boy, that sucks. But, of course, I got breakable dishes, but whatever. I guess I don't anymore because they're all broken. And, you know, I'm sitting there like, man, I really hope this anchor holds because it's blowing so hard it's becoming unmanageable for a vessel underway. And right around that time, our anchor broke free. So now we're dragging anchor. We get pushed out in the middle of this fjord. It's blowing 50, gusting 70. I throw the engine on, you know, full wide open, 3,000 RPM. I never run the engine wide open. I'm running it wide open. I'm trying to get the bow of the boat up into the wind. I can't get the boat up into the wind. The winds are too strong. I can't get the bow up. I'm trying to head back to where we came from. I'm trying to get the crew to go up there and pull the anchor back on board because it's now dangling 130 feet below the vessel. And then the CTD, our line we used to lower this probe, blew off the back of our boat. We had 1,700 feet of line dangling behind our boat, which then got tangled in our anchor, got tangled around our rudder. It's trying to wrap around the propeller. We're heeled over sideways. We're getting blown across a fjord. We're looking at at a rocky lee shore that if we don't do something quick, we're going to wind up on the rocks and, you know, maybe die. I don't know. But it wasn't good. They get the, you know, Nikki and Dana, the third mate, and Nicole, they get the CTD line in, and I get, you know, once that helped, you know, it helps a lot getting 1,700 feet of line no longer dragging behind your boat. And so, you know, I slowly, finally start getting the nose of the boat up into the wind. And after several hours of running at wide open, I'm able to get back into the shallow water we drug from, and I'm able to get the anchor to set again. But it was a crazy situation. You know, it was unexpected. We thought 30 knots. Hey, you know, 25, 30. You know, we didn't expect 50 to 70. Or, you know, I mean, that's just a lot of wind. And, you know, things get crazy. When things get crazy on a boat, man, they get crazy. You know, it ain't just one thing. It's like this breaks, and then that happens, and this happens. The next thing you know, you're looking at the prospect of losing your vessel. And if you don't act quick, you know, you got, you know, we had maybe, I don't know, 30 more minutes before we'd have been shipwrecked and in a really, really bad place to be shipwrecked. And like I said, we might not have made it to land. Hopefully we got in our dinghy, but you never know up here. But it's the Arctic, and, you know, I got another one of these damn weather patterns coming up in a few days, and now they're saying it's going to blow 50. It's like, well, Jesus, I mean, it blew 50 when they said 30. What is it going to blow when they say 50? You know, it's going to blow 100? I mean, damn. And I'm trying to do research, man. I got to operate for 19 days continuously around the clock in order to finish this survey. I got to finish this by the 22nd, and I need good weather to do it. Anyways, we got to go. Check the website. I got some videos on the website, oceanresearchproject.org, and you can always make a donation via PayPal on the website. Thanks again for listening, and I'll talk to you guys next week.
Kuya Nakase, Kuya Nagurao, Kuya Naikirase, Kuya Nakase, Kuya Nakase, Kuya Nakase,